Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome back to another spine-tingling episode of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I'm very excited once again, of course, this week with our guests because we've got Judy Lucy on the show from the New England Historic Genealogical Society. She's going to be talking about how to research your Irish ancestors. And there has been huge changes going on with that. You know, in the past, it's been very difficult because of burned census records and the like. Judy's going to bring us up to speed on what's happening with Irish research. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to Tom Reed. He's been involved heavily with the Freedmen Bureau Project. And what this is an indexing of the records of 4 million slaves and poor whites from the South who, between 1865 and 1872, needed a little help. And the project is making great progress. We're going to catch up with him on that, find out what you might be able to do to help bring this thing to completion. It's going to be a great thing for African-American researchers in particular. We will catch up with Tom. But right now, let's go to Boston and talk to my good friend, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society, David Allen Lambert. Hello, sir.
Hello. Greetings from Beantown.
I'm kind of going through this withdrawal right now, David, from Downton Abbey. My wife and I have watched this course for 6 seasons. We didn't catch up with it actually until about the 3rd season and then followed it faithfully all the way through to the end. And the other day, I found online trying to figure out exactly how all these family members of the Crawley family tied together. There's a Crawley family genealogy online.
And my goodness.
Yeah, it goes back. Remember at the end, it had the third cousin once removed. We had, Matthew and all these different branches of the family. And, of course, the children, now the grandchildren and the new husbands and all this. So I posted it on our Facebook page with Extreme Genes. It has been reposted countless times, viewed thousands of times now. It has gone absolutely nuts because everybody loves Downton Abbey.
Well, and I love Downton Abbey now, too. But I must tell you that I've only been a fan since Christmas time, where I sat down, we watched Season 1, we binged watched in about 2 months the entire series and watched the very last episode the night before it actually aired on TV. So I'm caught up with the clan completely.
What a great show it was. And I'm looking forward to what Julian Fellows comes up with next, because he's got a deal with NBC for a show called The Gilded Age, which is going to talk about New York City in the 1880s. And it's going to be on network television.
Oh, that's going to be
coming
wonderful.
Out next year.
Well, there's gold found everywhere. If it's not on TV, it's out in the eastern part of Galilee. I don't know if you saw the story about the 2,000-year-old Roman coin. That's amazing. Lori Ryman, while out hiking, looked down and found this coin that dates from around 107 AD of the former Emperor Trajan, which was an image that was in honor of him by the current Emperor Augustus. I mean, I was a metal detector kid and, you know, still use it occasionally. I've never found anything 1,000 years old just lying on the surface.
No.
But a very lucky lady.
Incredible.
Yes. So something washed out of a wall or something.
Because and it's in great
that's
shape.
Amazing. In great shape. And apparently it's so very rare. And I understand that it is now in the possession of the Department of Antiquities in Israel. So it will be shared by all the people out there. And that's the great thing about archaeology, is that you just never know what the amateurs might find. As
exactly.
We've seen with the Anglo-Saxon Viking hordes that we've talked about. Well, going back a little further west from Galilee, northwest actually, we go to just a recap on St. Patrick's Day history. Do you realize that St. Patrick's Day as a holiday didn't start until 1631? And that was centuries after, in fact, 12 centuries after the death of St. Patrick himself. It started as a church feast. But did you realize that St. Patrick really wasn't from Ireland?
No, I did not know that. Where
yes,
was he from?
He was a Roman.
No.
And we should really be calling it St. Myrwin's Day or Maywin's Day. His real name was not Patrick. It was Maywin Sukat, they believe. And he changed it to Patricus, which is a Latin term for father figure, and of course became a priest and is well known for converting the Druids to Christianity. And the American side of this holiday, well, it didn't come over with the Pilgrims. The first celebration in America that they can see occurred in your great old state of New York in 1762 And the idea of wearing green doesn't go back from the leprechauns. It's actually dates from about 1798 during the Irish Rebellion.
Wow.
So, gave me a little bit of a wake-up call on what I knew about my own Irish heritage.
Well, happy May Wednesday.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'll tell you, we're talking about things trending, and I am DL Genealogist on Twitter, and I've got a lot of followers, and I follow a lot of people back. But this tech tip that I came up with on the back of a post-it note, really, was to create a longevity chart. Well, it's trending and being retweeted all over the place. It's a simple idea. As I told you, I just took a regular genealogy chart, or a pedigree chart, as some people will call it, and instead of putting in the names, I put in the age at death of my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and great-great. And you look at it, and you realize how different of a focus we're looking at in genealogy. And if somebody died, like by they were shot or killed during a war or suicide, circle that number, because that's not a basis. But I look at it and I say, oh my, the average mean age that I could live to doesn't look like I'm going to push 90. So it's a fun little tech tip. It's free, something to do. And of course, our free databases and the ones we're highlighting this week include Brooksville, Maine, and Farmington, Maine, which are records from the 18th and 19th century of their birth, marriages, and deaths. That's all I have for this week from Beantown. I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, David. Great stuff. I'm talking to Judy Lucy with the New England Historic Genealogical Society, one of our friends there we've had on before. And Judy is in the process of working with a colleague on a handbook for Irish genealogy. And Judy, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you again.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's great to be here.
Well, this is exciting. Last week on the show, we had Senator Gillian Van Turnout from Ireland on, talking about all the things the government is doing to improve Irish research over there for Irish Americans. And of course, they're doing all they can so that they'll get more tourism out of it.
That's exactly what they want to do.
Yeah. And so as a result of that, I would imagine as you work on this handbook, things are changing really fast. What do people who have Irish ancestry need to know as things are evolving?
Well, first of all, things are evolving very rapidly. And I think when we look in the context of time from, say, the last few years when nothing of Irish records were really online, very little, to today, there's just been this huge explosion. And then in the last 2 weeks, the biggest thing to come online have been the Roman Catholic parish registers.
That is so huge. I mean, people have waited for that forever.
Oh, they have. And I remember when I first started out in Irish, I had to physically go to Ireland to use those records.
Yes.
They were on microfilm at the National Library in Dublin. And last year, the National Library scanned those microfilm images, and now they're online. But Ancestry and Find My Past have taken it one step further and have indexed those records.
Wow. And so this is now all available. And it's interesting because, you know, you would think about the cost of actually going to Ireland, and I think many of us wouldn't hesitate to do it. But sometimes the cost of actually paying to get these records online, we would hesitate.
I know, exactly. And they are both on subscription websites, so you do need to pay to use them. However, I think Find My Past is now going to offer that index to the parish registers for free permanently.
Wow.
So that would be a great plus for people who just want to go through and look at them and see if they can find their Irish ancestors.
Now, for people who aren't familiar, the issues with Irish research has to do with the fact that the Irish actually burned their census records back in the day.
Yes, they did. Back in 1922, during the Irish Civil War, there was an explosion and fire at the Public Record Office in Dublin, which was in the Four Courts building. At that time, they housed the Irish census there, and the censuses from 1821 to 51 pretty much went up in smoke. There are some fragments, and it's really a shame because the Irish census record was probably the best census in the world at the time. It listed everyone in the household, and I've seen those fragments, and one wants to cry at the loss. And then the latter half of the 19th century was destroyed by the Irish government.
Yeah, and what was their reasoning behind that?
I'm not quite sure if it was bureaucratic bungling, but it's simply, I think they used some of it for pulp or paper during World War I. They're such precious documents, but I don't think it was thought of at the time. And I don't think it was intentional. I think it was accidental. I think they thought there was another copy available, but I'm not really sure of the historical details.
Boy, talk about bungling, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
So what else has come out that people need to be aware of?
Well, in addition to the church records, there are some Protestant records online. Those are mostly transcriptions. And again, those are in subscription websites. A lot of the other records, the 1901 and 1911 census, which are the first full censuses for Ireland, they are online and are free at the National Archives of Ireland. If you have really interesting ancestors, the Irish prison registers have come online. And I have found a few of my own ancestors in those. So those are very interesting.
What were people in prison for mostly in those times?
Well, I think the British were trying to keep a very tight rein on the Irish. And so the slightest infraction you could be arrested for. So whether it was stealing your neighbor's chicken or breaking a window. In my case, my own ancestor, my great-grandfather, assaulted a local police constable in his town and was sent to the jail for 2 weeks.
And so you were able to find that record. That's awesome.
So, yes, and then 2 months later, he was on a boat to America. So now I know the reason why.
Wow, that had to be a great find then. Yes, that would tell you a story right there, wouldn't it?
It really was. I mean, I had heard about my great-grandfather and stories from my grandfather and my father, but sometimes it's hard to separate fact from fiction. But that certainly tells a little bit of a tale about the Irish rebel that he was.
Was the grandfather and your father, were they aware of this story?
I don't think they were aware of the prison record. I think they were aware that he had some difficulties in Ireland, some trouble, but no one ever really talked about what it was. And then I discovered that when the prison registers went online, I happened to go through them thinking that, well, it might be an interesting source to see if I could find anything. And lo and behold, there he was in County Cork in the city jail for 2 weeks.
That's awesome. What a great find.
It's a great find.
Now, you mentioned land records as well. Those are recent releases?
Those have been online for a bit of time, probably in the last couple of years. And the land records, particularly what's called Griffith's valuation, it's a land and tax set of records that were done during the time of the famine. And they serve as a census substitute, really, now because of the loss of the census records. And what it can do for 19th century research, it can actually identify the piece of property that your ancestor was on. It was a sort of a valuation of the property and the occupiers of each lot of land in Ireland.
So whether they owned it or whether they were just renting there.
Right, so whether they owned it, and primarily most people in Ireland did not own land. They
right.
were either tenants at will or they leased their property.
Mm-hmm. So that's exciting stuff. So you could actually find the exact location where your ancestors lived and go over and visit it.
And I've had people do that, and they've shared their photographs in front of the ancestral home or what was left of the lot and have sent me their photographs. That's really the fun part of helping people with their ancestry is when you have something like that.
Yeah, that really gets personal, doesn't it?
It really does. And for Irish Americans, I think that's really an important part of discovering your Irish ancestors' origins is being able to go over there and to stand on that little lot of land where your ancestors once lived.
And isn't that exciting that the government over there is recognizing that's a good thing for them, too, so they're helping us?
I know, and it's great. Nothing like this I didn't think would ever be possible 15 or 20 years ago when I was starting out. And I think it's just fabulous what not only the Irish government but the Irish people, there's been a real renewed interest in Irish genealogy.
Now, Judy, what about probate records in Ireland?
Well, probate is interesting. A lot of the pre-1900 probate records were destroyed in that great fire in 1922. Indexes survive. People can certainly use the indexes, but for the most part, a lot of wills were destroyed. There are some that have survived, and those are in Northern Ireland, in Ulster, for example. The Public Record Office of Northern Ireland in Belfast has taken and indexed the 1858 to about, 1920s or 30s probate records and put those online. They've indexed them, and then if there's an image available, they've scanned the image and put them up. It's just an abstract of the record, mm-hmm. not the actual will, but it's just an abstract.
Yeah, that's helpful, though.
It is. It's extremely helpful. I recently helped someone find one online just last week here in the library. It was really exciting.
So tell me one of your greatest Irish stories from your ancestry. You mentioned to me off air that your father's line is full Irish. What have you found that just blew your mind?
Well, I had always thought most of my Irish came over either during the famine or afterwards. And it wasn't until I was working on my grandmother's line. My grandmother wasn't born in the United States. She was born in Atlantic Canada. And when I decided to research her line, she was from Newfoundland. And what I discovered was that my Irish ancestors, through my paternal grandmother, actually arrived in North America probably sometime in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and that they were part of a group of Irish families that had helped found and discover this little fishing village in Newfoundland. So my Irish roots actually go very deep in Atlantic Canada, which I was very surprised about. I had no idea of any of this because my grandmother never spoke of her background. So that was very exciting for me because I think we typically think of Irish coming over in the famine or after the famine years. But a lot of Irish were here in the 17th century. Here in Boston, we can find plenty of examples of Irish in the records. So for me to find those kinds of deep Irish roots long before the famine here in North America was very exciting for me. And I actually went up there and visited the place and stood on the piece of land where my grandmother was born.
How'd that feel?
It was bittersweet. You know, it was a small village. All of the people made their living through fishing. And I kind of understood why they had to leave because of the economic downturn. And also just that life must have been very hard for them. So it was exciting to see it. I had heard about it through my grandmother and her sisters. But to go there was really, I was very glad that I did it.
How far back do you think a typical person could expect to go with their Irish research if they're just getting started today?
For Irish Catholics, probably maybe about 1800. For people with Protestant, it might be about the same. You know, a lot of people want to get back further. It's just going to be depending upon the place where your ancestors are from and the records and how far back they go.
She's Judy Lucy from the New England Historic Genealogical Society. She's working on a handbook for Irish genealogy. It's going to be out when, Judy?
Late spring.
Thank you so much for your time and coming on and sharing all this with us.
Well, thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, the Freedmen Bureau records are behind schedule when it comes to indexing. This has to do with all the freed slaves and many others. We'll talk to Tom Reed about it coming up next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. And, you know, it is so exciting always to be talking about all these different ethnicities and backgrounds as people try to find their ancestors. We've talked Irish today, and we're going to talk African-American right now with an incredible project that I think is going to be life-changing for a lot of people looking for African-American ancestry. And on the line right now is my good friend Tom Reed. Hi, Tom. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate being on today.
Hey, tell me about the Freedmen's Bureau project. This is a very big deal.
Very, very, very big deal. It's monumental for those who are searching African-American roots, because the project aims to take the records from the period between 1865 and 1872 that were kept by the Freedmen's Bureau, or the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands was their official name, and take these records that have been in the National Archives for years, were converted to microfilm in the 70s and then again in 2000, and make these records now searchable online for anyone who has family members so that they can type in the information and actually pull up documents. For years in the African American community, as you've done family history research, you run into what's called the brick wall, which is the 1870 census, the first time that African Americans were documented in federal records besides the Bureau records.
Right.
But the records that we have online. So now you can trace your genealogy typically back to 1870. But once you get there, it gets kind of that dark period where it's hard to find records. There's nothing for your family, people say, what have you. But these records provide that bridge and just bring light for millions of Americans. At the time of emancipation, there were nearly 4 million slaves. They became free and they needed services and they needed things like schooling and healthcare and education. And the Bureau documented all this. They wrote for the first time ever names of individuals. They weren't just tick marks in the 1850 census, but now they were actually names, and they had family relationships, and they had occupations associated with them, and where they lived, and when they were married. This provides a treasure trove of information that's invaluable for those doing African-American family history research, and the project just aims to take these digital images, transcribe and index them, and make them freely available and searchable for anybody who wants to do this research.
Now, you're working on the indexing project right now, and I know when we ran into each other at RootsTech, you were saying, oh my gosh, we're behind, because you're working in a partnership with the Smithsonian, right?
Yes. Since we launched on June 19th, 2015, which is actually a significant day in African-American history because it's Emancipation Day or Freedom Day, back in 1865, where the slaves found out that they were finally free. So in 2015, the 150th anniversary of Juneteenth, we announced this project in partnership with the Smithsonian's National Museum of African-American History and Culture and the Afro-American Historic and Genealogical Society. And those two groups have been helping us have events around the country, working through their societies or with different organizations to actually get people together to volunteer and index these records. The challenge, though, is these records are not simple records to index. Unlike maybe your traditional census or death records, one, they're handwritten. A lot of times in cursive, older, kind of archaic language,
right,
in some regards, you know, so it makes it so much tougher. And so we struggled a little early on with the project in getting all these records digitized kind of according to our timeline. Our goal is to have all the records indexed and readily available by June 19th. And then it takes a few months after that to publish all of the records and get them online, because on September 24th, the Smithsonian's opening the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And as our gift to them as a partner, we want to give them this database complete, ready, searchable for them to use.
And even before that, though, it'll be available online, yes?
Absolutely. So as we come across records, you know, we do these kind of in different groups of records. And for example, since June 19th last year, the Freedmen Bureau Field Office marriage records have now been indexed and published on FamilySearch.org. And that's where all of these records will reside. And as we complete other projects, for example, we've completed recently hospital and patient records. We've done some court records, applications of rations issued, those kinds of documents. We've finished the indexing and we're just in the publication process right now. So we look forward to seeing those records online here in the next few weeks. And then as we complete more and more projects, they'll be published online with the goal of completing all the indexing and arbitration by June 19th, and then having everything published and ready available by September of this year.
Boy, that's exciting stuff. And you know, it's not just the 4 million slaves that had been freed there. There are a lot of impoverished whites as well. Now, what's their involvement in this?
Well, you know, at the time during the Freedmen Bureau era, many were displaced by the armies during the Civil War, and they came to the Bureau seeking help as well. So there's families, not only African-American, but white families who are documented in these records. And so it provides a lot of historical context and a lot of detail that maybe would be lost if we didn't have this record set that had been preserved so carefully by the National Archives, and then that Family Search was able to acquire and use. So a lot of times people say, well, is this project just for African Americans? No, it's for all Americans. It's anybody who's researching their family, and anyone can be involved. You don't have to be African American. You don't have to be of any kind of faith background or genealogical expertise. You can participate in this project by helping us index, and then who knows? You may be like me, searching for family who are in these records where their line stops the 1870 census, and hopefully somebody will index these records, the name of your ancestor specifically, so that in the next couple of months, you'll be able to type in that name and find that Tom Baines in Montgomery County, Mississippi, that's my ancestor that I'm looking for in these specific records. So we're happy to have anybody and everybody who wants to participate involved in this project.
So these were freed slaves back from 1860. Getting actually registered for the first time during this Freedmen period. Tom, how long have you been looking for them?
Well, for my people specifically, I've been looking for them for probably the past 2 or 3 years. You know, I'm still kind of new to genealogy research myself, but once I kind of got to that 1870 census, I've really been wanting and thirsting to be able to get into these records and find my family who I knew were most likely born into slavery and received services during this period of time from the Bureau. And I'm just one of many. I know there's, you know,
sure,
Dr. L.A. Kissy in Los Angeles, who I helped with some of his family history research runs into the same thing. You hear some of the famous genealogists that are even on TV talk about this brick wall that everybody faces. And so it's just so important that we find the names of these individuals, but we can only find them if volunteers help us finish the indexing of this project.
Now, so far, you're almost two-thirds done, although two-thirds of it is not yet available on FamilySearch.org. But hopefully by June, we'll be seeing all of it, which is very cool. Where do people go if they want to be part of the volunteer effort?
If you want to get started with volunteering with this project, you can go to our website, discoverfreedmen.org. That's discoverfreedmen.org. And you can click on the Get Involved button and volunteer now. It kind of takes you through the steps. You can see the progress of the project there as well, as we have kind of a counter as of today at 63%. But maybe when this airs, we'll be much closer to our goal.
Well, great stuff. And we'll make sure we have the link for that on our Facebook page.
Thank you.
He's Tom Reed. Tom, thanks for coming on. And we can't wait to hear the completion and the rollout of all the records as a whole. It's going to be a great day.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry. He is our preservation authority. And today we're doing a little myth busting, Tom, because we have people who are misunderstanding some of the instruction that you've been sharing over the last couple of years.
And I try to do all my instructions in English, so I don't know what the problem is. One of the biggest things, we just did a trade show this last weekend. People would come up and say, hey, I don't want anything on a disc because discs are going away. Every place I read, they're going to not have discs anymore. That is a huge myth.
Yeah,
exactly. This is not like VHS and beta where there's a war and somebody's going to be victorious and somebody else is going to die. Just like Blu-ray. When they had Blu-ray with Warner Brothers and Sony, Sony went out and Warner Brothers went away. Discs are here to stay. The reason is people learn from past mistakes. If you buy the newest, greatest Blu-ray player, they will not only play Blu-rays, they'll play your old DVDs, they'll play your CDs, they'll play anything. So they're learning to be backwards compatible, so you shouldn't have a problem. The only time you have a problem is if you get some kind of a weird aftermarket disc that for some reason doesn't play on some certain machines. And that's usually because it's such an old disc, it's got problems with it, the foil's starting to go away. Because people don't understand it's not a rock, except of course the quartz one, which we'll get into. So they will go away. Discs, whether they're CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays, are actually burned with a laser, what we call the one-off disc. The ones you'd use at home to duplicate, and most duplicating centers would make for you, they're actually done with a laser, like a red laser. The new ones are going to be green lasers. And what it does is it takes that dye that's in there, it's like an LCD watch, and turns it on or off, so it's either a zero or one. And since it is a laser, laser is light. And I've had people that have left their CDs on their dashboards upside down, label side down.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And they go, well, no, it's not warped. Everything should be fine. Well, basically, the sun is a giant laser.
Yeah.
And it erased your entire disc.
So people are thinking of it like an old record.
Exactly.
A 33.
Right. If it's not warped, it should play.
Right.
That's not the case. So, I mean, you could leave it in your windowsill. You could have it on your kitchen drain board. And if the sun happens to come through part of the day and shine on that, there's a chance you could erase your disc.
Oh.
So two things are, don't put it where the sun's going to pass. If you have to put it where the sun's going to pass, make sure that the die side is down so the label side is up, because then you have a less chance of damage in it.
So essentially, put it where the sun don't shine. Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Can we say that on the air?
I think we just did.
Oh, okay. So basically, and this is a thing we need to get back to, we haven't talked about in a long time. People are confused about how a disc is actually made up. Even though the laser reads it from the bottom, your information is closer to the label on the top.
Huh.
It's just the way the disc is made. There's a big piece of polycarbonate on the bottom for the laser to go through to read the zeros, read the ones. But actually, that layer is very close to the top. So I've told people this, and I've had people bring us in discs that need to be resurfaced because they got scratched or they tried cleaning them with toothpaste and all kinds of weird things. You can take a paper clip on the top of even a Disney DVD, any kind of a DVD, and scratch it, and it's toast. Where you can take a knife on the underside, which is where the laser reads from, and make a big gouge in it, and I can still fix it, and it'll still play.
Really?
Because I haven't gotten into the foil layer. So as long as you don't hit the foil layer, you're fine. And if you've got a disc that's acting up and you're looking at it and it's clean, there's no dirt on it, but it's still skipping, the best thing to do is hold it up to a light, with a labeled sight towards the light and see if you can see like little pinholes coming through, because what that's telling you is that some of the foil has been damaged. It can be like a long line where it's gotten hot and actually expanded and cracked like your sidewalk would do.
Right.
There could be pinholes. And this is really funny. We get ones that have teething marks in them. The kids have actually bit the disc.
Wow.
And depending where they are on the disc, usually you'll still play up to that part because discs are played from the inside out. They're not like vinyl played from the outside in.
It must be kind of interesting for you, Tom, to have people come into your store and say, hey, I heard you say this when you didn't say this. I heard you say that when you didn't say that. We were just talking about people who believe that discs are going away.
Exactly.
And now you had another one, too.
Right. A lot of myth busting is about thumb drives. We've talked a lot about thumb drives on the air, and I've always said that's not a good place to keep stuff permanently.
Right.
Because they're volatile. The biggest thing you want to understand about thumb drives, I have one in my pocket I've had for probably at least 5 years. You told me off air that you've got the same situation.
It's maybe 7 or 8.
Yeah. Never had a problem with it. The thing is, you have to realize that thumb drives are like cars. You can have a Yugo thumb drive, which is what they pass out at the trade shows and at home shows and different fairs because they're so inexpensive. Because the silicone they use is really cheap. The components they use are really cheap. So all these things just cause problems with volatility on them. This is a good example of what you pay for is what you get.
Right.
If they're handing them out to you free, yeah, they're okay to use around your home, you know, to transfer from one computer to another. But I wouldn't put my permanent stuff on them and expect them to last because they won't. And a lot of times what they do is when they make these thumb drives that they hand out at trade shows, they permanently put a little like ROM chip on them that has information. When you plug it in your computer, it automatically opens up your computer to the internet. So it goes to their website as an advertisement. Sometimes they just have like QuickTime movies on them. They'll come up and play on your computer. It's not going to hurt your computer. It's just that this thing is on a ROM chip. So it might say it's a 15 megabyte or gigabyte or whatever size you're looking for. And so since they have a ROM chip, which is read-only memory,
right,
then the RAM, which is read and write and erase, is going to be so small, and they don't have to use very good components because the ROM is the main thing. That's all they care about is to show you the advertisement. So we have them around for little things if we need to transfer something one off to one computer to another computer. Scan disk is good, but they also have some that might not be as good as other ones. Just go and read the reviews on them. Make sure you buy a decent one. And like I say, if the price is too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
Right.
There's a lot of information. VideoMaker, which we talk a lot about on the air, they're always reviewing things. They've got a lot of reviews where they've gone in and studied thumb drives. You can just go on the internet and type in Google thumb drive reports, and you won't believe the pages that come up that these people, it's like they have nothing better to do. They just sit and test all this stuff. They sit and run this thumb drive, do this to it, and just see which ones fail, what caused the problems. But if you look at big places like Facebook, they store all their stuff on Blu-ray discs. They don't use thumb drives. They could do whatever they want because they've got the money. But they use Blu-ray discs because it's the less volatile media. So like I say, even if you get a really good thumb drive like we have, I still back it up. I go and put stuff on it, whether it's accounting or whatever, go into my computer, plug it in, and immediately do what we teach everybody to do. The trifecta is you want something on a disc, a good Tile-Udin disc that's going to last forever. You want it on a hard drive. And you want it on two clouds and make sure your two clouds aren't related. Like we've talked about that. Dropbox is great. I love Dropbox. We have our own that's called Lightjar, which is basically piggybacked on Google. We take the Google frame, put on top of it. So you don't want to say, oh, I've got Lightjar and I've got Google, because really you don't. They're both on the same server.
Right.
So even though Google has them all over the country, and if Google ever went down, would probably be at nuclear war. So it really doesn't matter anymore.
Wow, that's frightening.
I know. But so you want to be careful. Remember, hard drive, disk, cloud, and you'll be good and everything will be taken care of. And use your thumb drive sparingly.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Hey, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks once again to Judy Lucy from the New England Historic Genealogical Society and Tom Reed for filling us in on what's going on in their world. Take care. We'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.